This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome, junkies. You are witness to a great becoming. Because it's another episode of Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com.
You just said coming.
I did. I stepped right into it. I wasn't paying attention. The moon was full, and I stepped right into that one. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am Brian Salisbury, and that man over there is Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going, Cargill?
It's going well. We're talking Manhunter this week.
We are indeed talking Manhunter, and we're not talking Martian Manhunter. I don't want people to think this is some kind of spoilery what happens in the post credits of Suicide Squad podcast. We're not talking about Martian Manhunter. We're talking about Michael Mann's.
Does Martian Manhunter show up?
No, he does not. I don't know if that's a spoiler to say a character doesn't show up, but he does not. There was a split second during Suicide Squad that I thought Martian Manhunter was going to show up.
I didn't even know you saw Suicide Squad.
I did see Suicide Squad.
We'll have to talk about that after the podcast.
Off the microphone.
Off the mic. But yeah.
But speaking of the microphone, if you would like to hear us talk into these microphones more, you can check out our back catalog of episodes on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or become a fan on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Or if you want to become a super fan, you can become a patron at patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Kick in a little bit there and we will kick you some bonus videos that only you get to see. We really appreciate you helping us keep the lights on.
See.
Yes, or get to hear, I guess. I'm using Professor Jeff's script, I guess.
You really are, because...
I've been recording with him too much again, so it's like, yeah, I'll just kick you videos. You get to, they're not videos, they're podcasts.
No, we
make no videos.
We have faces for radio.
And asses to match. So, yeah, we just do the audio part of it. But, hey, speaking of keeping the lights on, you might want to do that after you see the creepy first incarnation of Hannibal Lecter, first official movie in the Silence of the Lambs franchise. We're of course talking
franchise.
It is a franchise when you it is it's a
yeah,
property
yeah
we're talking of course about, as our one junkie summer progresses, 1986's Manhunter.
Nationwide victims.
Yeah, this is Will Graham of the FBI.
One killer.
Have you ever seen Blood on the Moonlight Well?
William, you're gonna make yourself sick or get yourself killed.
Multiple trails.
Just you and me now, sport.
One hunter.
I'm gonna find you, damn it.
FBI agent Will Graham. Manhunter.
Here's the interesting thing. One of the things we've been talking about this whole theme of this summer hasn't just been how junky 86 was, but for those of you
who've
been
listening.
How
junky is it?
It's so junky. this is the summer that really kind of changed everything, and Manhunter is a great example of that. Manhunter is a film that failed, that should not have failed, that looking back in retrospect, you're like, how did that movie not do amazingly well?
Right.
How did one of the best crime films of the 80s not do well at the box office? And how did a Hannibal Lecter movie not do well? Like, how did a movie that would spawn four other movies and a three-season TV series based on a best-selling novel, how did that movie not do well?
It's almost impossible to fathom in a post-Hannibal TV series world that any iteration of a Hannibal Lecter, Will Graham story would not do well.
Directed by a guy who was one of the hottest directors of the 80s. Like, mm-hmm. This is, you know, this is Michael Mann coming hot off of
Okay, now advice. Now we've said coming hot. We've oh, talked about coming a lot in this episode. It is called Manhunter. you can't see the face I'm making, home audience. Sorry about that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you guys lucked out on that one. you guys dodged a couple bullets on that one, Neo. Yeah, so... you have totally...
I'm sorry. Michael Mann was coming
Michael
hot.
Michael Mann is... He's, you know, super hot at this point. Hot off of Miami Vice. He's got this book. It's produced by Dino De Laurentiis. It's got a really intriguing cast, and it just did not do well. And it did critically well because, you know, you look at this movie and it's a really great movie.
It did critically well because critics have eyes and could see this.
Yes,
so.
But nobody else went and saw it. So much so, and it did so poorly, that Michael Mann decided not to do a sequel. The cast decided not to come back. Brian Cox, they wanted to bring him back for this sequel. They'd hired another director to come in and do the sequel. And so they went and made a sequel to this movie that ultimately the America thought was the first one.
Yeah.
Like it's
just completely forgotten about movie Manhunter.
Yeah. It was a movie, you know, we're talking 5 years later. It's not like 20 years later, they made a sequel to this. The movie, the Silence of the Lambs came out 5 years after this and, would ultimately win an Academy Award would like, it's the, in the history of films. I don't know that there's ever been a sequel to a movie so well received. Like yeah. When people talk about greatest sequels of all time, nobody ever mentions Silence of the Lambs because they forget that it's a fucking sequel.
Yeah, it's kind of like Manhunter is kind of like that third older Manning brother that everybody forgot about who was supposedly even better than Peyton. And then the younger brother comes out and people just literally forget that the older brother existed. I know that's a sports analogy and probably made a lot of people uncomfortable, but it is very much like that.
I know I've heard the name Manning.
Manning Hunter is what we're talking about here on Junk Food Cinema this week, obviously. But yeah. there's a reason I think that this, and I want to start by saying I'm not putting myself in a category above anybody, because when I first heard about this movie, I was in college working at a video store and I had no idea it was connected to. It was one of the ones I had reshelved a couple times. Had no idea it was a Hannibal Lecter movie. Had no idea it had anything to do with Silence of the Lambs. They never watched it.
They changed the title.
Yes, it was going to be Red Dragon.
And and by changing the title, they went with something very 80s and very bland.
Yeah.
Like, for it's very easy to be like, what the hell is Manhunter?
Why the hell is the title coming up on the screen in green neon? Oh, Michael Mann, that's right. Why.
That's why. The outrun of outrunniest.
Yes, very much so. But and then I didn't see this for the first time until a few years ago, but I fell in love with it immediately. And I kind of feel bad for Brett Ratner, because I had actually in college watched The Red Dragon that came out in the 2000s that I thought was pretty good. And I still think it's decent, but
it's pretty good. Pretty good is fair. It is. The thing is what Brett Ratner was doing with Red Dragon by he was remaking this, but remaking this with the cast that had been in those movies and trying to adapt the look to look like Demme's universe.
Yes, that's what I was going to say, is that the biggest difference between Manhunter and Red Dragon is that you see what a lack of style looks like when you revisit Red Dragon after Manhunter. You see exactly what studio system movies look like. And as much as I kind of still enjoy Red Dragon, it hurts to like revisit it directly after Manhunter, because there is no style whatsoever in Red Dragon. It's just...
And Michael Mann is just pure style.
And that's all Michael Mann. And you know, and I think Michael Mann is the perfect person to do a serial killer movie, because Michael Mann is, we've talked about this before, this is not the first Michael Mann film we've covered.
No.
This is not even the first Michael Mann related property we've touched in this series.
This month.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, like Michael Mann is a director that we know well, that is very revered around these halls. And we've talked about this before, but he is a director who is obsessed with minutiae, obsessed with the finest of fine details of any type of character he's creating. For Thief, You know, he was really, really intricately concerned about what tools James Caan used, the lingo that criminals use, the world that the professional thieves lived in. I mean, he talked to professional. He had a professional thief as the consultant throughout the whole movie.
You know, now that I'm thinking about it, I hadn't actually put it together. We're just, Junk Food Cinema is just kind of slowly working through all of the films of Michael Mann with buffers in between.
Yes.
He's kind of like our Werner Herzog.
Welcome back to this episode of Michael Manhunter, where we just we pretend to cover all movies when really we're just covering the catalog of Michael Mann. Yeah, we've talked about Thief. We've talked about Miami Vice. I know at some point we're going to talk about The Keep because, oh my God, The Keep. But there was a run of films from about 1981 until about...
I thought we had talked about The Keep.
We may have mentioned it in passing, but we have not done a full episode on The Keep.
All right. The Keep is one we definitely need to do.
But you have very few directors who can boast that from 1981 till about 2009, just winners. Just fucking home runs down that whole stretch of time. An entire generation of successful movies, whether that be critically, commercially, or most of them both. So it is unbelievable to me how
I love how it
that
stops
winning streak.
In 2009. I know exactly which movie you're talking about,
and which makes me sad because that should have been a movie I loved, but just not so much. But Manhunter, I think that's why he's the perfect person to adapt Thomas Harris and to bring, as Cargill was saying, a new type of a new feel to this type of movie, and really a character who is almost as obsessed and as crazed as the killer he's trying to find, just in a different way. But Will Graham, played in this movie by William Peterson, who would parlay this role into
an entire career playing forensic science scientists and investigators.
Basically, Grissom is the television version of Will Graham before we got the television version of Will Graham.
Yeah.
And so, like, you have him playing Will Graham, who is tracking down a killer who has murdered two families and in really brutal fashion and seems to function on a lunar cycle. So the next full moon, he's probably going to do it again. So Will Graham, who used to be an investigator who is trying to, you know, get out of the business, it's affected him very adversely, is pulled back into the investigation by Jack Crawford, played in this film by
Dennis Farina,
R.I.P., this is a very, and it's not surprising that you have William Peterson and you have Dennis Farina, both of whom were in Thief in very small roles, by the way. It's kind of interesting because Michael Mann himself is a Chicago director. Chicago is very important to him. William Peterson, Dennis Farina, both Chicago actors. Like, it makes a lot of sense that this is the cast that he put together. And I think pound for pound, even with the sort of I would argue elevated star power of Red Dragon, in the sense that everyone in that movie had a big break by the time Red Dragon came out. And in this movie, everyone in it really hadn't been pushed over the top in their careers when this movie came out. Pound for pound, they're still, like, I would probably take the cast of Manhunter over Red Dragon in their specific roles. And that's not to slight the cast of Red Dragon, which features Ralph Fiennes, Harvey Keitel, Edward Norton, and of course Anthony Hopkins playing Hannibal Lecter again. But there's something really gritty and really painfully personal about every performance in this movie. Whether it's William Peterson as Will Graham, who I love his Will Graham, because when he does that thing that Will Graham does where he starts talking to the killer who's not there, he seems legitimately angry at him. Like, he's like, you had to touch her. You had to touch her, didn't you, son of a bitch? And you're like, whoa, Will, he's not even in the room. Like, take it down a notch. But, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's very interesting. Also, I'm curious. I know that Michael Mann spent time at the behavioral sciences unit while he was studying this, while he was putting this together.
Oh, yeah. Also, former cop Michael Mann, I think we should say.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's also the reason he's perfect to direct this.
I'm not sure whether Will Graham spent, you know,
William Peterson.
Yeah, William Peterson spent time at the behavioral sciences unit. But the guy he's playing is very eerily similar to a very real guy who exists. And that is one of the weird things. We'll get more into this as we go on. But this the story and the movie actually is very mirrors history a bit, unintentionally. And what would end up happening is this is kind of, this movie is a very stylized Hollywood version of the relationship between Bill Hagemeyer and who's one of the first four FBI profilers, and Ted Bundy. And yeah. The interview scene in this movie where Peterson is interviewing Brian Cox, and we see Brian Cox.
Yes, Hannibal Lecter, played in this movie by Brian Cox, who at the time was a stage actor who nobody had really heard of.
Yeah, and he in that scene, the way that interrogation works, the way he gets how Hannibal Lecter acts towards Will Graham, and how he gets him interested, and how Will Graham is being very humble and very down to earth and not feeling, you know, he never uses the authority to put himself better than Lecter. He's always under Lecter and playing to Lecter's ego, yeah, and letting Lecter play his games because he knows how that works.
He lets Lecter take credit for a line of reasoning that he had already considered.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is, yeah, he's like, you already thought of that, didn't you?
I considered it. Yeah.
And the thing is, I actually know quite a bit about this particular thing because I wrote a script about Bundy, and I've actually read the FBI transcripts, and there's so much of these sequences and what Thomas Harris wrote in the actual transcripts. You know, it was very much Ted Bundy wanted to read the files. He wanted to see it. He wanted to see pictures. Yeah. And he wanted to put things together, and he wanted to be useful to the police. And he thought he was brilliant, and he thought he could solve all these things. The irony of it, you know, the delicious irony of it, if you will, is that in the movies, Hannibal Lecter is always right. Hannibal Lecter gets it. He's brilliant. He's a genius. He has this all worked out. He gives the investigators just the clues he needs to get it right. And in reality, Ted Bundy was way off. Like, he was interviewed multiple times about the Green River Killer. And he had this entire, when you read it on the page, brilliant layout of who the Green River Killer is. And he's worked out all these details, and you're just, you, when you read how he breaks down who the Green River Killer is, you're like, holy shit. It's like, wow, this guy really fucking gets it. Like, he's put thought into this, and he's built a profile of a guy that, oh, all of that was wrong. When they finally caught the Green River Killer, every bit that Bundy had laid out was absolutely dead fucking wrong. And so, but the way Will Graham deals with crimes and the way he talks to Lecter is exactly the way these guys at the time, when the movie was being made, like, this is not something that, you know, that Michael Mann would have necessarily been privy to, but maybe he was. And that's the thing, is maybe, because there's in an interview, he said, there are, I met guys exactly like Will Graham at, the BSU. It makes me wonder if he was specifically talking about Bill Hagemeyer, and if he had read any of these early interactions with Hagemeyer and Bundy, because this is literally like this stuff. We're talking like 1984 to 86 when Hagemeyer was first getting to know Bundy and first interviewing him. So if Mann was given access to that, then he was seeing really fresh investigation. Like, he was getting access to stuff that you would be surprised he'd be getting access to. So that element of this in rewatching this stuff really fascinated me, because it's like, how much did Mann have access to? Because wow, is a lot of this stuff really on the nose? As much as this stuff is high fantasy and high excitement, high tension serial killer stalking, there is a lot of actual investigative truth to what is going on in this film, which is very much Michael Mann. And again, one of the things that you and I love about Michael Mann.
Yeah, is that investigation is almost a fetish for him. Like, I think he is Will Graham. In this movie, watching William Peterson investigate crime scenes is how I imagine Michael Mann approaches every script. It's like he literally just stands there, and he always is by himself. He doesn't let anybody walk the scene with him. He just stands there by himself and just goes through every single room, every single thing that happened. He's literally reading the case file aloud and making observations. And I mean, this kind of movie where the forensic investigator is looking at the smallest of smallest details, and those things become so crucial in apprehending someone. Saving a life comes down to whether or not you identify, you know, a company label on a tape, or whether this type of talcum powder was used versus that. Like, that kind of thing has to be just absolute crack for Michael Mann. Like, it's exactly the reason he's the perfect person to tell the story, and exactly the reason why this movie is so engaging, because Will is that obsessed with detail. And then on top of that, Michael Mann's obsession with detail in his cinematography. This movie is a fucking masterclass on cinematography.
Oh, yeah.
Holy crap, is this thing beautiful.
So much so, there's a scene in this movie that we gave a visual nod to in Sinister. It's a scene that me and Scott both love, and when we were talking about it and writing it, I don't remember who said it, but one of us was like, you know what the scene needs to be? It needs to be that scene from Manhunter. It's like, yeah, the scene, oh god, yeah, when they're going to the house with the flashlights.
Oh my, okay, well,
That scene in Sinister, anyone's like, they ripped off Manhunter, yeah, we fucking ripped off Manhunter. Why? Because we fucking love Manhunter, and we wanted that scene was just so fucking cool, and it's like, fuck yeah, this is Manhunter.
You saved me from a question I was going to ask toward the end of the show of you specifically, was because I watched that opening scene and I was like, this is fucking Sinister. Wait a minute.
That was totally a visual. That was a visual homage to Manhunter, because that scene is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, that the one time we ape cinematography of another movie like that is in one of the films. So it's literally one of the kids aping the cinematography from Manhunter to make his own murder film.
A tiny little Michael Mann fan.
Yeah.
And that was,
you know, one of the themes we dealt with Sinister was, you know, the notion of, children imitating this art and imitating this violence they've seen. And we thought it would be really cool to have one of the characters imitating a scene from a movie that we dug, and that visually we were just like, you know, is so great. And Scott just executed it perfectly. And so, yeah, no, if you've never seen Manhunter and you watch it and you have seen Sinister, you're going to be like, oh, dude, that really is that fucking scene. So, but yeah, so we had a kid aping Michael Mann. And
that's why, incidentally, trivia, not on the IMDb journal, but a piece of trivia, in Sinister, Bagul is played by Tom Noonan. Few people know this. It's not documented anywhere.
It's not Tom Noonan.
It because it's not true, but it could be true. He's under a mask. You wouldn't know. But Tom Noonan is our tooth fairy in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
The killer played in Red Dragon by Ralph Fiennes. Tom Noonan, the movie benefits from the fact that ever since the first time he was on screen, on stage, or looked at, the guy is just unsettling. Like, there's just something about Tom Noonan's presence. Even in those moments where he's playing Francis Dolarhyde very sympathetic, there, because I think that's one of the things this movie does well, is as heinous as his crimes are, there are moments where you find yourself almost feeling bad for this guy, because it's clear he cannot connect with other people on any level that isn't violent. And it's just, even in those moments, it's still just like, I am really nervous that Tom Noonan's here.
Oh, he's one of the coolest, interesting, weird offshoot scenes in this film is really cool. And he creeps it out. The unconscious tiger scene.
Yes.
Where we've got
Joan Allen.
Yeah, we've got Joan Allen.
Of Death Race.
Of Death Race.
Just saying.
Well, of many things. Joan Allen, fucking amazing, fucking gorgeous. But she's playing a blind woman here, and she's able to... She has a vet friend who's letting her feel this tiger, and that has been put unconscious. And so the tiger is awake. It's staring into the camera. You're nervous,
yeah,
because it's like, that's a fucking tiger.
Hey,
like,
hey guys, that's a fucking tiger. Anyone? Okay,
and it's not right. Unconscious.
Yeah,
it's been drugged, but just any moment, like you're just like, she's like putting her hands around its mouth and like it's like, ah,
it's a Metallica tiger. It's sleeping with one eye open.
It is like, and it is. You're looking, and this scene is just so cool, and it's neat, and it's this character building scene, and the camera swings over, and you're looking at Tom Noonan. And you just get chills and you shiver. You're just like, oh, you creepy motherfucker. And he's not doing anything. It's not like he's over there masturbating or going, but he may as well be.
He may as well be.
Like, just the way he's looking at her, you're just like, you need to not look at another human being like that. You need to stop and get out of my nightmares right now. Like, he is fucking creepy.
In fact, if you stop looking at her like that and just whip it out and go to town, like, I'd be less uncomfortable than I am right now. I'm just saying.
It's he has this way in this movie of looking at people and just ooking you the fuck out. It's so great.
Yeah, and it serves the movie tremendously well. But in terms of the cinematography, I think two of my favorite moments in the whole movie where you're just in awe. Like, that is one of the great things about this movie. And again, why if you watch Red Dragon afterwards, you are going to be severely disappointed, because the moments were the first time he interviews Lecter at the jail, which was actually an art museum where they filmed it. The back and forth shots between him and Lecter, it's in many ways how a lot of people traditionally frame conversations, just one shot, almost the over the shoulder kind of thing, except that the camera is framed so that you're looking through the same two bars every time you go back and forth between Lecter and Will. So the bars never move. The bars don't move at all. You just keep going back and forth between them to kind of... It's ironic because it's meant... The bars are meant to create distance between them, but the whole time that they're talking, you realize that there's not a lot of difference between them.
No.
So it's just... It creates this great juxtaposition where it's like, oh, these... And in fact, the scene ends with Lecter saying, "You caught me because we're a lot alike." And I think that's the reason that that's how that scene ends.
And that's, well, yeah. And that's also what what I was talking about earlier. That's actually something that Ted Bundy, that's why he connected with Bill Hagmeier, is he believed that he and Bill Hagmeier were one and the same, and that they could have easily flipped positions, that Bill could have been a serial killer and that Ted Bundy could have been a cop.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the most realistic elements of that scene, like that conversation really fucking happened between two other dudes, one of the greatest monsters of the 20th century. And that theme in that movie is so great.
Yeah.
It's just so powerful. And yeah, that whole concept of, and you know, it's interesting, that scene is so interesting because it's a great, You keep talking about Red Dragon, and that reminded me, it's a great juxtaposition between what this movie is and what Silence of the Lambs is. Because in this movie, you see that cell, and that movie looks exactly like what a cell in the 1980s looked like, where Hannibal Lecter would actually be. And then we have the version 5 years later that won an Academy Award, which is a fucking fantasy. Like this underground, high-tech, made of like plastic... You know, plexiglass, you know, cages.
It's Magneto's prison from X2.
Yeah.
Buried underground.
Yeah, it's super slick. It looks really cool. You know, the worst of the worst are kept down here.
Yeah.
And it's like, that place doesn't really exist.
I'm sorry, Clarice. Are you at Arkham right now? Where the fuck are you conducting this interview?
That is what that is. Now, it's fucking cool as shit.
Of course it is.
And it's evocative, and oh my God. The one thing I want to stress is I do not want in any way for it to come across like I don't love The Living shit out of Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, of course.
I've actually watched Silence of the Lambs more than I've watched Manhunter, as much as I watch Manhunter, because Manhunter, they're like, Silence of the Lambs is pure Hollywood, and mm-hmm. it's really entertaining, and as disturbing as it is, it's entertaining disturbing. Manhunter's disturbing.
Yeah.
Like, the things that they do in this movie, what he does without going over the top, it's just so unsettling of this kind of a film. And I honestly feel, to go back to the beginning of this conversation, feel like that is why this movie didn't connect with people in 86. Yeah. Like, in 86, people wanted Cobra. You know, they wanted the right
wing.
The
army of maniacs.
But they wanted the right wing, you know, gun toting guy to go around and shoot all these folks. They had, you know, the serial killer thing was way too real at this point. Like, for some reason, and nobody's sure why, there was more serial killer activity in the late 60s through 70s to early 80s than we see today.
Yeah.
And that's what prompted the creation of several groups. Until 1984, there was no such thing as an FBI profiler. Reagan created a group specifically to research violence and to profile. They wanted a group of guys that were just a think tank to sit around and think shit up and talk to serial killers and create programs that could help the FBI and police figure out serial killers before they before people realized that it was a problem, you know, catch them after their first or second or third kills, as opposed to, you know, someone like Bundy, who shrugged it off and said, let's just say 30.
Yeah, they're still fucking finding bodies from Bundy.
I mean, it's this is that era when this was a very real thing, and it was terrifying, mm-hmm. and the police had only just now started getting their shit together. Because that's one of the things about this era that it's very hard to look back on and truly understand. But until the early 80s, there was no coordination between states. It was reading through the transcripts of the circus that was the last week of Bundy's life, and seeing all these cops show up with maps and files and unsure if they had, if certain girls were victims of his, trying to close up cases, showing up without maps because they just thought he would just be able to remember and tell them where it was. And he's like, dude, it was a roadside where I dropped a girl 15 years ago. Like, I haven't been in that state in years. I only lived there for a couple of months. I have no idea where this place is. What do you mean you don't have a map? Like, there was just no coordination. And it was such a clusterfuck that the FBI had to start stepping in and really start taking up. And that led to the creation of more and more programs until we got to the point where we are now, where, you know, the minute there's a crime, you know, it's a trope in movies now, where a cop is on the job and someone's killed, and then the feds show up and the feds are trying to take it from us, and this is a pissing contest of territory. And it's like, yeah, the feds are showing up because if the feds are showing up, they're taking it seriously. Why are we demonizing these guys in movies? But we do that. It's that whole thing, like everybody fighting over the territory of it. But so this movie is happening right during this period where there is this consolidation going on. There is this this sense of, we're finally getting our head wrapped around what this is. But at the same time, America is fascinated with serial killers, like, just fascinated, which is why I have the one thing I don't understand is why this film didn't catch the way Silence of the Lambs did. Why nobody went and saw this particular gritty, realistic serial killer movie that 5 years later it would dominate the conversation.
Well, I think it's because of what you said, because it was still too real. And this is not a film about, I mean, if you really think about the way that Tom Noonan's character ends in this movie. It's not as satisfying as Marion Cobretti blowing away an army of maniacs with a giant gun with a laser sight.
Oh my God, that scene is so good though.
Oh, it's great. But what I'm saying is for people who
I know.
That's way too, that serial killers are still too real.
Oh yeah, because he's blown away cops. Anna Gatta De Vita is blaring.
Oh God.
Shit is exploding.
That is my other, that was the other one I was going to say, the other scene in this movie that honestly is one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever, and every time it comes on I just cheer, is the scene where William Peterson is at Tom Noonan's house. They figured out who the Tooth Fairy is. They're at his house, and Tom Noonan looks up, and in classic third act Michael Mann slow motion, William Peterson is running toward the window, and it's not the killer, it's the fucking cop who comes bursting through the window in slow motion, and as soon as he enters the room at that exact perfect moment in Inagata De Vita, like, that scene just makes me stand up and cheer.
Yeah.
I love it so fucking much.
It's so great. The only problem I have is the movie focuses so much on realism, and then you have a cop jumping through a window, and it's like, yeah, he would have been dead when he got to the other side.
Of course he would have been
dead. Like, that is as fast as he was running. That's how you kill yourself, is you run through a window. Like,
it's, but Will Graham's fucking crazy.
He is. And yet, it's like, I kind of want, there's a part of me that kind of wants to just see, like, the, you know, the Family Guy version of that, which is, the cop running up and wait for backup. No, runs through the window, lays there bleeding to death. And the killer just going, what the fuck was that?
Yeah, you really shouldn't have done that.
Now I have to, and having to grab a mop or something and just like, God damn it, Will.
God damn it, Will. But yeah, up to that point, Tom Noonan's just blowing away cops left and right with a shotgun, and it's, yeah, and I think it's interesting you mentioned that this was the time in history, because the new Shout Factory Blu-ray that came out for Manhunter, which is great, by the way, there's a segment where they're talking about, William Peterson's talking about Michael Mann, and talks about how one of the things that they all did together is, him, Dennis Farina, and Michael Mann, is they went and talked to the very first serial killer profiles at the FBI. So those people that you're talking about, that group that was formed.
They did talk to Bill Hagmeier then.
That's, they must have, because they literally, they said they had talked to the very first guys that were hired by the FBI to be profilers.
Yeah, like, yeah. That was a brand new thing. I'm going to blank on the, it's got a weird acronym, but it's a Center for Violence. And American Center for Violence and something.
We just call that Florida now.
A lot of the guys were kept in Florida. Oh, a cool little Bill Hagmeier bit.
Ted Bundy was put to death in Florida, right?
What?
Ted Bundy was put to death in Florida. By the way, this is something I can't believe we've never talked about before. We're apparently both huge psych nerds. How have we never talked about serial killers before? I wrote my entire college thesis on the BTK serial killer, who, according to IMDb, I haven't been able to substantiate this anywhere else. The book Red Dragon is based upon, apparently, the BTK serial killer in Kansas, who was the subject of my whole fucking, like, honors thesis in college. So that's just interesting.
Yeah. Bill Hagmeier, the thing is these profilers became superstars.
Yeah.
Like, in very, very weird ways. Bill Hagmeier, because he became best friends, Bundy referred to him as his best friend, a bunch of the serial killers only would talk to Bill. And I interviewed Bill and had asked him about it. And the story that he told me, it kind of melted my brain, was that he went and sat down with, what is her name?
Eileen Wuornos?
Yeah, Eileen Wuornos. Sat down with Eileen Wuornos and he goes, Miss Wuornos, my name is Bill Hagmeier. I'm here for, and she's like, I know who you are, Bill. You can call me Lean.
Wow.
That's what my friends call me. So you can call me Lean. And he's like, are you sure? He's like, you were good with Ted. So you're good with me. Jesus. And so, like, she, having never met Ted Bundy, felt a connection with Ted Bundy and felt a connection with the guy who Ted Bundy felt he could trust. And so these people got to be very well known in the serial killer community. And it's kind of a community. I mean, that's what's so fucking weird about it. They keep track of each other. They know who each other is. You know, they hate each other. They have rivalries. You know, it's fucking weird. Just that whole kind of ecosystem. But yeah, these guys who started in 84, they were all FBI agents already. And they were recommended for this group from other divisions. And Bill was the youngest guy.
Yeah.
And so these guys were all there, and their job was to go and interview the serial killers that would talk to them, work up a profile on them, and then start putting that all together. And then they would go in and assist, with police departments and such like that. So they weren't like necessarily taking over, but like Bill Hagmeier would go out and sit and talk to the police there and walk them through it and help them just by being a resource.
Yeah.
And it's really an interesting culture. And yeah, so they did go and sit down with those four guys. That's fascinating.
Bill Hagmeier's job is exactly what I wanted to do when I left college. And then I found out that only like 8 of those jobs exist in this country.
Oh yeah. And the thing is the stuff you deal with is really profoundly, deeply fucked up. And the people you deal with, but that's, you know, that's what really tipped me off this time was there's a way that William Peterson, that answers it for me. Cause there's a way that William Peterson responds to Lecter in that scene that is, it's Bill Hagmeier. Like, yeah. It is Bill Hagmeier. Just the way he downplays it and the tone in his voice when he goes, I considered it, but you know, no, I, you know, the way he's playing to the ego and the way he refuses to take credit for, you know, for catching, for being smarter than Lecter and having caught him. He won't do that because he doesn't feel that's who he really is, that he really isn't smarter than him. He just got lucky. And that is very Bill Hagmeier. And so that fascinates me to know, I mean, to know that he went and met those guys, because I guarantee that's where Will Peterson got it. He probably, because that's one of the things when you talk to Hagmeier and a lot of other guys in that business, there's not a lot of ego to them that shines through. They're very humble guys who are like, no, there's a lot of police work was involved in that. A lot of people did a lot of good work, and I just was happy to contribute.
Wouldn't it be crazy if that meeting with Hagmeier is also where Grissom came from? What if William Peterson's made a whole career out of just being Bill Hagmeier?
It's entirely possible.
That would be insane.
That would not, you know, that wouldn't surprise me. Because Bill Hagmeier is also the guy who, when Jodie Foster was on the set of, was on Quantico when they were shooting for Silence of the Lambs, she was like, I want to meet the guy. I want to meet the guy that sat down with Bundy. That is essentially what I'm doing. And they sat out on the steps for a couple hours and she picked his brain. He is definitely that guy that a lot of stuff has been based upon. And so, it's fascinating to actually, cause I had not rewatched Manhunter since I talked to Bill, and rewatching that scene, I was like, Will Grissom, Will is just fucking, he's Bill.
Yeah.
And to know that he talked to him, it's like, okay, this all comes together now and it just all falls into place.
And it's exactly the kind of thing that Michael Mann would have demanded of his cast, is to really like dig into the reality. So I get what you're saying. Yeah, the jumping through the window thing is probably the most illogical.
It is the least realistic thing in an incredibly realistic movie.
This is true, but it's still beautifully shot and executed so well. And again, the music in this movie, I have a hard time believing it's not Tangerine Dream that did the score. It's not, but holy shit, does it sound like Tangerine Dream, and thus feels even more like a Michael Mann movie, as does the fact that I feel like if they were going to write a biography or shoot a documentary about Michael Mann, you would have to call that thing The Bluest Night, because there is nothing bluer than Michael Mann night shots. Like, it just has this like humming
in the
azure 80s. Yeah, in the 80s, like, it is just, it's exactly what you see in all the best episodes of Miami Vice.
It's funny, I mentioned something earlier, I don't know, I mean, this is something that you junkies need to know about. There is a thing right now, there is a weird offshoot style called Outrun, and it's mainly a style of music, but it's that some of you might be familiar with, but it is a style of music and an essence and a style of art that's all kind of coming together that is a pastiche of this era of the 80s, like 84 to 87. And it's kind of a mix of the music from a lot of these films. You know, it's very much, you know, the electro, the big thick electro score that, you know, that we love, you know, stuff that you saw out of a lot of the Italian movies and the low budget movies of this era.
Right.
Mixed with pinks and greens and covers of video games and all of that. But a lot of the visuals of it, there's like a theme, running theme in Outrun of like palm trees and Miami and this whole essence of it. And it's all just Michael Mann.
Yeah.
Like it's literally this whole essence of this movement going on, underground movement, is heavily influenced by how Michael Mann made stuff look in a handful of films in this era.
Yeah.
Mixed with a lot of the people that were aping that visual style and that were doing that with all the, like, one of the things that happened in this year that we've already talked about is the pinks and the greens that show up in a bunch of the movies in this particular year where everything is pink and green neon. But yeah, the way he shoots that sky and the way that sky looks is fucking gorgeous.
Yeah, and it's funny to me too, like thinking about it and all of the things that Michael Mann does, his night shots, the way he's able to use, you know, or manufacture moonlight and create this sort of this blue gaze, and everything is really bright at night, and yet he's still bold enough to keep a lot of his characters in shadow, in the dark, in these scenes where it's nighttime and everything else is otherwise way too bright to be night. So it's just really interesting to me how he, again, creating juxtaposition. And I another thing we haven't mentioned yet, kind of another tie-in to Band of the Hand, which was the last...
Band
of the Hand. The last thing that Michael Mann touched that we talked about is that Stephen Lang is playing Freddie Lowndes in this movie. He is our Freddie Lowndes in this movie, who suffers a fucking horrible fate.
Oh, yes.
Oof.
And God, Stephen Lang, God, I love Stephen Lang. In fact, we were just talking about this earlier because we're starting with Junk Food a la Mode. And yes. So we went and saw our first movie for Junk Food a la Mode. And at that movie, we saw the movie separately, had the same trailer attached, that the minute we saw the trailer, we were both like, that's the next Junk Food a la Mode.
Oh,
if ever
yes.
There was a movie for Junk Food a la Mode, it's a new Stephen Lang movie called Don't Breathe.
Yes.
That looks fucking junk food-tastic.
Oh, for sure.
For those of you that have not seen the trailer yet, the base premise is a group of criminals break into a blind man's house to steal some money that he apparently has in there, only to discover he doesn't have money in there. He's a serial killer. He's really fucking good at what he does. And now they're locked in this house in the dark with a blind man stalking them. And they have to be very quiet so he doesn't catch them because he finds them by sound. So it's fucking...
Much like a T-Rex.
It's fucking Stephen Daredevil.
Lang, starring...
It's evil Daredevil. Fucking chasing criminals. Like, and that's the thing, is like, if he weren't a serial killer, it would be Daredevil, but they made him but Stephen Lang looks so fucking badass in this movie that it's like, it's everything we love about Stephen Lang. And of course, yeah, here Stephen Lang is not the badass in this one, but he got to be the badass this same summer a few weeks before in Band of the Hand.
Yeah,
and this was Stephen Lang's summer,
and starring
two movies that didn't do well by Michael Mann.
Yeah, what the hell. And starring Stephen Lang as a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Don't Breathe. Yeah, we're definitely going to cover that for Junk Food a la Mode. But
yeah, if that movie's good, we'll definitely be covering the shit out of that.
Or if it's bad, because the whole thing about Junk Food a la Mode is, if we paid to see it, we're going to talk about it one way or the other. But hopefully, we're hoping beyond hope that it's good. And we're hoping beyond hope that you will check out Manhunter, because it's so fucking... It's beautiful. I think the main difference between Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter, like on a like tactile level, is that Silence of the Lambs is a movie about the perversion of beauty. It's a movie like as far as its visual signature is about not just visual, but the idea that someone who is of high class, someone who loves opera, someone who loves fine art, someone who is very sophisticated, is also a monster. And the whole scene where he's escaping from prison while, you know, a beautiful sonata is playing and he's beating someone to death and ripping their face off. It's very much about the idea that beautiful things can be corrupted. And the interesting thing about Manhunter is nothing happening in the movie. None of the things that are occurring are beautiful. Everything about the movie, as far as the story, if you took the visuals out of it, is very straightforward detective, very blue-collar investigation. But the movie itself, the look of the movie, the cinematography is what's beautiful about it. So it's almost kind of the same idea, but in a very different way, because it's not pushing that that contradiction in your face. It's just the movie looks that good, no matter if you're following Will Graham. Again, just a kind of nod to Michael Mann's attention to detail. There's actually a scene where he's talking to Lecter on the phone in his hotel room, and if you look behind him in the distance in another building, the light from the elevator of a different building is going up and down throughout the entire conversation at very specific points. That's not an accident. Michael Mann had fucking people in the other building in the elevator telling them exactly when to go up and down during the conversation. Yeah. Like, again, just crazy obsessed with detail.
Which is why his movies look so great.
Yes.
It's funny you used the word tactile. That was exactly the word that I wanted to use to describe this movie, because it is a tactile movie.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's so weird, is it feels... This describing this movie as gritty is not, I don't think, is fair for this movie, because I don't think it's a gritty movie like what people think of when they think gritty.
No.
But man, does it feel real. Man, does it feel like very down to earth, like mired in the real world, which is completely different from everything else Hannibal Lecter related. There are four other movies, three seasons of a TV series. There is tons of just Hannibal Lecter material out there, and this is the only bit, this only episode in the entire thing where it feels like Hannibal Lecter could exist in the real world.
That's very true.
Where Hannibal Lecter isn't a supervillain. He's a real guy. Like, you yeah. see the weakness. Brian Cox brings a weakness to Hannibal Lecter that I think is why people prefer Anthony Hopkins, because Anthony Hopkins brings a profound strength that at any moment Hannibal Lecter is outthinking you. But that can't be possible because Hannibal Lecter got caught. Like, Hannibal Lecter lost his shit. Like, Hannibal Lecter is not a perfect serial killer. He is not a shark. He is not the perfect killer. He is a very deeply flawed killer, a very flawed man. And Will Graham brings the worst out in Lecter, and Lecter hates him for that, because yeah. he's the guy that beat him and sees that weakness and sees him as a weak man. And Brian Cox brings that out here in that performance. Like, there's a moment where of the anger when he knows that Will Graham has already thought that before and has already figured that out and has already moved past it, and it pisses him off. Mm-hmm. And you see that restrained anger in Cox. The only problem with Cox here, the only problem, as great as his performance is, the Scottish slips out every once in a while.
Oh, it so does.
It just keeps slipping out, and he's fighting against it. And it's very, you know, eventually people were just like, you don't hire Brian Cox and take the Scottish out. Like, Brian Cox did, the whole reason the internet exists now, the entire reason they keep it running, is so whenever you want to try a new scotch, you can Google Brian Cox telling you how to pronounce it. Like, that is, and it is the single greatest thing on the internet. If for some reason you still have not seen it, Google this. And it's literally just him sitting in an easy chair with a glass of scotch beside him, with the bottle. He pronounces the name properly and then drinks it.
See, and that actually jumps us forward to the junk food pairing of this particular episode.
Of course it does.
Because I actually struggled with this a lot, because, and I think this is actually tantamount to why this movie is so great. And I know a lot of the times we cover cult films, we cover exploitation movies, we cover B movies, but always movies that we love. I feel like there's the other side of this show where we're covering films because they have been neglected, completely forgotten, that are masterpieces, that are absolutely phenomenal pieces of cinema. And when that happens a lot of the time, it makes it harder for me to come up with something that...
Something junky
to compare it to. And that's the problem I had with this film, is I could not for the life of me come up with anything. And then I was like, yeah, Brian Cox sitting in that chair on the internet telling you how to pronounce scotch.
Bunahaben.
Lagavulin. Sit there and have yourself a glass of 16-year-old Lagavulin. Enjoy this movie. Think of Brian Cox from the start of it all telling you how things are, explaining to you what the hell is going on, and just marvel at how much style you possess in that moment, because that's exactly what this film is. This film is style, but also substance in equal measure, and that is why it is so great, and that is why Lagavulin is the junk food bearing.
So you're focusing on Lagavulin.
Yeah, or no, you know what? What other scotch would you recommend?
Of course the Bunahaben. Bunahaben 18 is amazing. Glenlivet is one of my go-tos. Glenmorangie. Also a very common thing to find in my house. Also very much like a scotch. This has aged very well.
Oh, so like, well.
It's a movie that you sit and watch and it doesn't feel dated. It feels exactly where it needs to be. Like it's one of those films that when you look at it, you know that by remaking it again, you would never capture what works about Manhunter.
Agreed.
You would only get the super slick Hollywood version of it. You would not get this down to earth tactile version, and it is wonderful, and it is aged well, and it is definitely worth revisiting.
I recommend this for anyone who jumped into this series at the NBC series or the NBC show and decided that these were characters they were invested in, because I feel like watching this prior to watching the show is going to feel like the perfect amuse-bouche for the feast of Hannibal on TV.
I haven't watched Hannibal.
Oh my god, dude!
Everybody says that, and that's the thing.
Oh my god!
You know, it's one of those things that I loved this series. Like I loved.
You mean the film series?
Yeah,
yeah.
And then the very end, so much so that the day the book came out for Hannibal, the day that book came out, I was there waiting in front of the store. Picked it up. Spent an entire day in bed reading, blew through the book in one read, and got to the end and went, "What? Are you fucking kidding me?" And then of course the movie was, I'm not a fan of Hannibal, the movie. And then they did the prequel, and I was like, all right, Thomas Harris is going back to the well. And I hated that. So after that, it was just like, I can't do any of this anymore. And they, everyone's like, you got to see the series. And I was just kind of like, but everybody has really since convinced me. And of course, fucking Mads, man. So, watching Mads Mikkelsen do this, I actually rewatching, this, and thinking about this, I was just like, I should just sit down and watch that. I think I'm going to start that series tonight. So that is probably what I'm going to do tonight, is I'm going to sit down with a bottle of scotch and start watching
Hannibal. I recommend you do that immediately. I think that's a great idea. But that's going to do it for this week's show. I hope you guys have enjoyed. And I want to throw a special shout out to our listeners, because over the last few days, our levels on Patreon started to dip below 200, and then it was like watching the stock market fluctuate. People literally pledging enough money to get it back to 200, and then if it dipped down, they would, other people would chime in, like trying to keep it at 200 for Junk Food a la Mode. And I was blown away by your generosity, guys, and trying to keep it at that level, come hell or high water. I was very, very touched by that. Also, we got a shout out from director Tom McLaughlin of Jason Lives, Friday the 13th, Part 6, who described...
Let's be fair. You got a shout out.
Well, but he also said...
You earned that fucking shout out.
Well, I wrote an intro because one of the things Film School Rejects has been doing lately, which I think is so great, is even for podcasts, the lead-in text is kind of like its own mini editorial. So you're reading something whether you listen to the show or not. And I just think it's a great kind of pairing of two things. And So that's kind of what he was focused on. But then he did listen to the show, and we now have our official first endorsement from a filmmaker, which is that the podcast.
Actually, it's our second. Oh, it's our third.
Is it our third?
Our third. Joe Lynch responded.
Oh, that's right.
And James Wan responded.
Oh, well, there you go.
When we did Junk Food Masters.
Mr. McLaughlin said of Junk Food Cinema that it is off the charts entertainment at its glory, gory best. I think that needs to be on a fucking t-shirt. So if we ever start making t-shirts, it's going to have that quote from Tom McLaughlin on it. But guys, thank you so much for joining us. If you would like to hear more of our episodes, they're all on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like it on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Around.
All right.
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MASSAWYRM, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
All right. You can find me online on Twitter at Bry Guy Salisbury, or on Facebook. My Facebook page is facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. That's going to do it for this week. We will see you guys all at the next crime scene.